Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food when we come back. Before we get into producing good food, I received a letter not too long ago from a listener up in Canada. Fred in Canada was wondering what your thoughts are on the law of the land, Indian land title, applicable laws, and the ability to pass or enact laws. If I could direct your attention to maps located at www.Anishinaabe.org. I don't know what that word is, Fred. It's spelled A-N-I-S-H-I-N-A-B-E. Anishinaabe, maybe that's somewhere close to it. On top left, you'll note the maps section, and there you'll find the map of 1763, the Royal Proclamation, and a map of Canada post-1763. As the Royal Proclamation has not been amended or repealed or spent, those boundary lines of 1763 still stand. And maps are from the Duryan Report, 1971 Federal Government of Canada. Now, with no change in the boundary lines aside from holding the guns, where does the state derive its authority to set up shop and to pass laws? Those who are born on those lands are not subject to Indian law or the law of the land. He asks the question, are they not subject to Indian law or the law of the land? Does not ownership of the land or is not ownership of the land a prerequisite to one's ability to pass laws? And I would entertain your thought on this subject insofar as it may affect the way in which you may now think with respect to jurisdiction to force parens patriae and taxation and so on. And this is signed Pat from Tuttle Island, somewhere up in Canada. Well, Pat, you ask a pretty poignant question there. Basically, you want to know, where does the Canadian authority for passing laws and getting into your face come from? And the answer to that question is, it comes from Leviticus 25:23. So let's flip over to Leviticus 25:23, and I'll show you a little something here about land law. In Leviticus 25:23, we read a short, plain statement concerning land law. It says, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me." Now that tells you quite a little story right there, Pat. It says, "The land shall not be sold forever, because the land is mine." Who owns the land of Canada? Well, it's an entity that we call God. The Muslims call him Allah. The Asiatics call him Buddha. Does it make any difference what you call this divine fellow, this creature, this God, this creator? In the Bible, he's revealed as the creator of heaven and earth. He's the guy that we refer to here as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, this fellow, this God, made a contract with a fellow named Abraham. Contract. A contract is an offer. In order to have a contract, you have to have four elements. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. So the offer to Abraham was, you practice my law, I'm going to give you these benefits. Now the benefits that you receive, Pat, as an heir and an assign forever, under the terms of the contract negotiated by God with Abraham, are recorded in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus chapter 26. So we're in Leviticus chapter 25. Just turn the page and you'll be at Leviticus 26. First 14 verses tells you here's what you're entitled to. Here's what you're going to get if you practice this law. Now, under that law, there's a law here. This is a statute that says the land shall not be sold forever. We, the white man, decided that our God made a mistake, that he didn't know what he was talking about. So we have created real estate law. That's why we license real estate brokers. And a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. Look it up. It's a definition of what a license is. It's legal permission by some authority to do something that's illegal, to commit a crime. A real estate broker selling real estate is a criminal, and he goes to the state to get a license to carry on that criminal activity. Now that's simple enough to grasp. Now there's a contested issue of fact as to who owns that piece of real estate that you're describing called Canada. I'm here to tell you that that piece of real estate is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Creator of the universe, and there isn't a single human being drawing breath in Canada that owns one square inch of that piece of real estate. And for that matter, there isn't any human being on planet Earth that owns one square inch of this planet. It is true that there is a contested issue, and I live in a place called Missouri, and there's a corporation located in Jefferson City, Missouri. It's called the state government, the state of Missouri. They claim that they own this piece of real estate. And that question of ownership over this piece of real estate called Missouri will be settled at the second coming of the Messiah. At this moment in time, this entity, this corporation, exercises what we call the police power over this piece of real estate. Next door, there's another police power, another government, another entity called Oklahoma. And they exercise police power over that piece of real estate. And there's another piece of real estate up north called Canada. And over in Ottawa, you have a corporation which is set up, and they claim that they own it. So your question, when you ask, well, then, doesn't ownership of the land then become a prerequisite to one's ability, an ability to pass laws? And that's exactly correct. Exactly. And this entity that you've got up there in Ottawa claims that they own that piece of land. And they enact laws. And they've got the police power. They got those red-coated Mounties up there carrying billy clubs and guns to enforce their laws, their rules, their regulations over that piece of real estate. Now, the thing that bothers you is that before those white men got there, you Indians, and I presume you're an Indian because you're asking the question, where in the hell did these white men get the power and authority to come up here and enact these laws over us, the people of Canada, the natives of Canada? And the answer is, it's by conquest. Conquest. We just come in by force of arms and take it away from you. But then you shouldn't bitch because you didn't own it anyway. And the Indian peoples have always said that we don't own the land, we're just occupiers of the land. And that there's the Great Spirit, there's this God, there's this entity, there's this something out there that we don't know what it is, but he owns it. All right, now let me tell you what happened to you, Pat. Over here in Deuteronomy chapter 4, our God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now this is a God that's foreign and alien to you people up there in Canada. He said in verse 25 in chapter 4, he said, when you shall beget children and children's children, and you shall have remained long in the land. And when you have corrupted yourselves, and you make a graven image, or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of the Eternal your God, to provoke him to anger. What that says in layman's language is, when you give your God the finger and tell him to kiss off. Verse 25. He says to us, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that you shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereinto you go over Jordan to possess it. And you shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. All right, so sit back and relax, because the white man's days in Canada are numbered. I don't know how long the numbers are, but I'm just telling you, you read it there with your own eyeballs. Now, there's an important reason for that. Let's flip over here to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Let me give you a couple of more insights. Deuteronomy 7, verse 9, he says, Know therefore that the Eternal, your God, he is God, the faithful God, which keeps covenant, keeps contracts, and mercy with them that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. If the white man in Canada were to obey this God and keep his commandments, you would have these white men, these Canadians, ruling over you for 1,000 generations. So you can thank your lucky stars, or you can thank your God, or you can thank somebody, that the white man in Canada has not been obeying the God of Abraham, and has in fact been giving him the finger. And this very same God said, and when you do that, you will not prolong your days in the land, because I call heaven and earth against you, I'm going to throw you out of it. He goes on and he says, And repayeth them that hates him to their face. The white man in Canada will be paid to their face to destroy them. And he will not be slack to him that hates him. He will repay him to his face. Now this God's a little bit different than the God of the Christians and the Muslims and the Buddhists and others. This God here looks you right in the eyeball and says, Give me the finger and I'll pay you to your face, sucker. I won't sneak around in the shadows. I'll kick your ass and I'll kick it where you can see it. One more point. Verse 11. He says, You shall therefore keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which I command you this day to do them. All right. Now here's the way God is going to deal with his enemies. Here's the way our God dealt with you. When we came in there, we kicked your butts out. We took over. We practiced the law of God, and we took your land by force of arms. And we have held it from that day to this. And if we would obey our God, we would keep it for 1,000 generations. Now fortunately for you, Pat, we didn't do that. Well, now we've been giving our God the finger, which is good for your side. Now listen to this. Turn over here to verse 9. Or it's chapter 9, rather. It's chapter 9, verse 5. He says, Not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart do you go in and possess their land, but for the wickedness of these nations. The Eternal your God does drive them out from before you, and that he may perform the word which the Eternal swore unto your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand, therefore, white man, that the Eternal your God giveth you not this good land to possess it because of your righteousness, because you're a stiff-necked people. Now here's the kicker, Pat. Flip over here to Exodus chapter 23, verse 20, and I'll show you the answer to the riddle. Exodus 23, verse 20. He says, Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place that I've prepared. Now beware of him and obey his voice. And provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you shall indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto your enemies, and an adversary to your adversaries, because my angel shall go before you and bring you in unto the Amorites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, Jebusites, and I'll cut them off. Now, as it relates to you and your relationship to the Canadian government, whichever side will obey God and keep His commandments, because He's the owner of the land. As He tells you plainly in Leviticus 25, verse 23, He says, the land is mine, and don't you forget it. The land is mine, and it shall not be sold forever. Now, the white man in Canada has been buying and selling that land and making merchandise out of it from day one. So if you people up there will obey this God and keep His commandments, He will give that land over to you, and He will establish you in it forever. And you shall not be removed. So it just depends on who's going to practice the law of the owner of the land. Now, so far, the white man is in possession, and he says, I own it, and here are the laws that we're going to impose. Pat, you obey God and keep His commandments. There are 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. And the God of Abraham will throw the white man's ass out and establish you in their place. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's your whole tribe or whether it's just your family or just you all by yourself. Now, just quickly, the Gordons at one time were established at the Needle Rock Ranch in Northern California. The Gordons did not obey God, did not keep His commandments, and the Gordons have been evicted from the Needle Rock Ranch, and today it is a state park. Now, this Gordon came to Missouri and decided that I would obey God, keep His commandments, and I have been established in the land, and I will prevail, and I will stay in the land and be established forever to 1,000 generations so long as we obey God and keep His commandments. He'll do the same thing for you that He does for me or anybody else. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're an Indian, a white man, a black man, or some other colored man. The guy that obeys the owner of the land is the guy who's going to be established in it. Which now brings us to the subject matter at hand. That is producing good food, because good food comes off of the land. And one of the crimes for which we are being evicted from the land is the violation of 15 agricultural laws. There are certain laws that are in force and effect. For instance, land Sabbaths and Jubilees. And because we won't practice these land Sabbaths and Jubilees, we're in the process of being evicted from off of the land. But it's more deeply rooted than that. You see, these land Sabbaths and Jubilees are necessary and imperative to the fertility of the land. It's the natural methodology for building soil. And here's what happens. Remember last time I told you that down in Alabama and Georgia and the southern states, the plantation guys would come in and they would clear the forests off, and then they took that virgin land under the forest filled with organic material, and they would farm it for 15 to 30 years and wear it out and then move on. But after they had abandoned it for 100 years, they could come back to that land again 100 years later and it would have its fertility back. What was going on there? Well, here's what happens. Vegetation grows up on the land, and it dies, and it falls back on the land, and it rots and decays. Land fertility comes from the dead organic material from generations past. That's where fertility comes from. It doesn't come from Dow Chemical or DuPont or OrthoGrow. It comes from the dead bodies of the plant material that grew there in the past. All right, so it's simple. It's simple enough. What we do is we add organic material, and that's what Edward Faulkner discovered, and that's what he demonstrated. Now, I mentioned to you green manures. Now, here's what a green manure is. It's simply vegetation that grows up. You can take a piece of ground out here that is just clay, and you know what it'll grow? Weeds. The first thing you see in there is thistles, briars, and brush. I mean the stuff that is so tough and so nasty that nobody wants to get near it. It grows up and it dies down. And as it grows, it turns. It creates organic material. Now let me show you where the top of the food chain is. Go over to the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. Go up to the tree line. Now go up above the tree line where you find rocks. No trees, no brush, no grass, no vegetation. But on the rocks you will find lichen and moss. Now, lichen and moss can live directly off of inorganic mineral chemicals and convert those inorganic mineral chemicals into organic material called lichen and moss. Go a little further down the mountain, and you'll find little short shrubs. And the further down the mountain you go, then the bigger the plant life you find. And what's happening here is that the plant life at the top of the mountain dies and it's washed down and becomes the food for the roots of the bigger plants. Pretty soon you get down to the 6,000 foot level and you'll find trees growing. Between 3 and 6,000 feet are the biggest trees. Below 3,000 feet, the trees get smaller and stubbier. The land gets drier. Then you get the grasslands. Alright, now out in the grasslands, the great prairie regions of the United States, where I mentioned to you in Iowa, for instance, the soil is 6 foot deep. Soil builds at the rate of 1 inch every 90 years, or about 1 inch per century. So that in a millennium, 1,000 years, the soil will build up 12 inches, 1 foot in 1,000 years, 1 foot of topsoil. The buffalo eats the grass. The grass goes through the buffalo and comes out in the form of manure. The manure breaks down. That manure is the food for the roots of the grass for next year. The buffalo comes along next year and he eats the grass. As he eats the grass, it processes through his body, the manure comes out, and it becomes the food for next year's grass. Over 1,000 years, 12 inches of topsoil is built up. In 6,000 years, 6 feet of topsoil is built up. Or it can be washed in a flood. I mean, you can get silt, you know, that comes down the river. Now, that's the process. Now, to maintain the land forever so that it never loses its fertility, you have to let it rest 1 year out of 7. A guy by the name of Kerry Reams tested this theory and proved it. Scientifically, what they did was they took a known weight and measurement of soil and put it into a closed container and then planted seeds. They measured the amount of water that went in. And they measured the amount of product that came out and weighed the whole thing. And when they got to the end of the year, it weighed more than when they started. And it's called the process of photosynthesis. You see, the light mass that's coming down on the earth is matter. And that light mass matter, when it acts upon leaves, is converted into organic material. Now, there's 3 or 4 factors that come in here, and you can see this at work. When you go out here in the woods and you pay attention to the trees, you'll see that not all trees grow everywhere. For instance, we have rock ledges here where cedar trees will grow, but oak trees won't. And that's because the cedar tree can more directly convert. In other words, a cedar tree needs approximately 10% organic material and 90% inorganic material to form wood and to build a tree. The oak tree is a little different. He's got to have 50% organic material and 50% mineral to build wood, to build organic material, to build a tree. A carrot, on the other hand, can't grow in either soil. The carrot has to have 90% organic material, 10% inorganic material to build a carrot. So we have a food chain just like we have with animals. At the bottom of the food chain is lichen or algae or something growing in the water. So a little fish comes along, he eats that algae. A bigger fish comes along and eats the little fish and on up the food chain until an eagle swoops down out of the sky, grabs the fish, takes it up, and feeds it to his offspring. We call the eagle the top of the food chain, and we call the algae the bottom of the food chain. Plants work the same way. As the plants grow and die, their dead bodies are consumed by 186,000 organisms per cubic foot of soil. So if you were to take a cubic foot of soil, 12 by 12 by 12, tear it all apart, get out your microscope, and look and count all of the entities, you would find ants and termites. They're at the top of the food chain in the soil, and they're breaking down the cellulose fibers. They use them for food, they break them down, make their homes out of them. As you get on down, you get to little nematodes, and you get to bacteria and microscopic life in here that all work upon the decaying process. And remember that Faulkner pointed this out in his book, What is Soil? And actually, his book is entitled Plowman's Folly. But in chapter 2, and what he's talking about, what is soil? Soil is made up of the dead organic material. And the easiest place for a plant to get this dead organic material is right out of the last year's dead plants. And surface incorporation of those dead plants right on top of the ground, just like you see in the forest, the leaves fall down on top of the ground. Nobody plows them under. And the ground is fertile. And the ground is has tremendous nutrients for the trees to grow. There's no drought in the forest, and there's no shortage of nutrients for the plants. Until man comes along. He cuts the forest down and burns it. So he burns up 90% of the organic material, which in the forest is growing above the soil level. It's sticking up in the air in the form of wood. There's only 10% left in the soil. Then he starts planting corn and tobacco and cotton. And then he takes that cotton, puts it into bags, and he ships it away. It is physically taken off of the land and shipped away. The corn is physically taken from the land and shipped away. Whereas out in the natural forest, as the tree grows, it is converting inorganic rock, mineral rock, along with the organic material that is being produced from the inorganic mineral rock into wood, which dies, which falls on the ground and is eaten by the ants and the termites and converted into organic material. And the mixture of inorganic and organic creates more and more wood. It's a perpetual motion machine fueled by the sun. When the sun goes out, the machine stops. But as long as the sun continues on with the process of photosynthesis, we have a machine that just continues to go on and on and on. And letting the land rest, as Kerry Reams demonstrated in his experiment, letting it rest once every 7 years, combined with the sun, combined with the natural processes, is enough to maintain that soil fertility forever. But we don't do that. And that's because once every 7 years, if we let the land rest, we lose 14%. It's a 14% investment, is what it really boils down to. So, somebody came along to us and they sold us on the idea of chemical fertilizers. Remember, I mentioned this, it makes all the sense in the world. Take the waste material from the petrochemical plant, from the production of oil, and petroleum into gasoline and tars and solvents, you've got this waste material that we call nitrogen and potassium and there's one more, NPP. These chemical fertilizers. And so let's take that and put it on the soil. And it makes plants grow. It really does. But it doesn't add any iron, copper, or iodine or any trace elements because it's not in it. None of the trace elements are in those petrochemicals. But it is food. It's the same kind of food as refined sugar is for human beings. It tastes good. We love it. We thrive on it. It makes us fat. But we get sick. And that's what happens to plants on chemical fertilizers. The plants eat and consume the chemical fertilizers. And they love it. It's like eating refined sugar. It's like crack cocaine. I mean, these plants just turn green, and they just grow like weeds, and they produce bins and bushels of corn and wheat that doesn't have very much in the way of nutritional value. Then we come along and eat those, and we can't get enough of it, so we eat more and more of it. On the last program, I told you why. When you eat a banana, it is so concentrated, the potassium is so concentrated in that banana. By the time you eat one banana, that's enough. If you can eat two bananas, boy, you were really short in potassium. By the time you eat that third banana, you're going to puke, because once you overdose on natural foods, you puke. When you overdose on cocaine or heroin or meth, you die. You cannot overdose on honey. God has designed foods as fuel for your body. You have to have this fuel. And if you get a good high-octane fuel that has all of the vitamins and minerals that your body needs, you'll never get sick. Which is going to be the kiss of death to the medical industry, because if we ever get to a point, either on our own or where it's forced upon us through some outside source or force that causes us or forces us or induces us to eat good, healthy, nutritious food, your medical industry is going to die. Your insurance industry is going to die. Your medical industry is going to die. The pharmaceutical industry is going to die because there's not going to be any market for their products. For instance, when was the last time that you were healthy? Can you remember that? I mean, you didn't have a headache, and you didn't have any allergies, and you were just feeling in the pink of things, and you were just really, really healthy and energetic, and you felt really good. All right, can you remember that? Now, when you were feeling this good, did you go to the doctor? Did you go sit in the doctor's office for 3 hours and wait for a doctor to come in and then go and take your clothes off so he could stick his fingers up and into the various orifices in your body and kind of feel around a little bit? Did you do that? Hell no. If you're feeling good, boys and girls, you don't need a doctor. You need a golf bag. You need to go golfing, or you need to go play tennis or something. Now, the only time you go to the doctor is when you're feeling bad, when you're diseased, when you're ill at ease, when you're in pain. That's when you go to the doctor. Now, you won't go to the doctor when you're feeling good, and you won't feel good as long as your body's got all the nutrients that it needs. It's just that simple. No fuss, no muss. Let me give you a reminder. At the midway point here, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is sponsored, or the Law Hour, I should say, is heard 7 days a week here in the U.S. and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, or they're religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not 100% endorsed by the Law Hour or Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, now I mentioned to you that there were certain laws that were required for us to practice in order for us to be established in the land. Remember, we talked about this fella, Pat, from, where was he? Pat, from Turtle Island. I don't know where this Turtle Island is. I've received more than one communication from this fella, or at least from Turtle Island, Canada, over this thing called the Indian land claim issue. In the United States, when I've just mentioned this in passing, that here in the United States, we decided to deal with the Indian tribes by treaty. Now, we were instructed by our God to destroy them from off the land and not to make any contracts or treaties with these Indian nations. But after all, what does God know about international relations and treaties and one thing and another? So we decided in 1778 that we would deal with the Indian tribes by treaty. So we made treaties with all of the Indian tribes. 378 treaties with 378 Indian tribes, all but two. The Bruno and the Shoshone Indians up in Idaho. We didn't make treaties with them. That's another story for another day. But in 1946, to correct some of the thefts that we had created over the years, we created a thing called the Indian Land Claim Commission. And then we signed the Indians up to these contracts. Well, the Indians have signed up on these contracts by treaty. That's the way we get them entrapped. It's the way we trap people. We get them to sign up for Social Security, birth certificates, marriage licenses, driver's licenses, business licenses. And then we regulate and control them under the Commerce Clause. After all, they're all volunteers. They're under contract. They have a duty to respond, a duty to reciprocate, a duty to perform, specific performance, we call it in law. A duty to specific performance under the terms of a contract. Well, the Bruno and Shoshone Indians didn't sign up. And to this day, the piece of real estate from the center line of the Boise River to 30 miles, I believe it is, on each side of it, from the mouth down at Caldwell up to the source in Atlanta, Idaho, is still in dispute as to who owns it. One thing is for sure, the United States of America doesn't own it. The state of Idaho doesn't own it, and the Indians never claimed to own it, but we never sized their title to the land. Never sized title to the land. And it's this thing of sizing title that's so important. Well, it's either that or you do it by force of arms. Now, you can do it by force of arms, but to do that, you have to destroy the inhabitants from off of the land. Otherwise, they have a residual claim to the land by use, occupation, and possession. The way you claim land is by use, occupation, and possession. That's why God tells us. He says, you will not prolong your days in the land because I'm going to deport you from it. So in Deuteronomy 28, he tells you plainly, you Americans and Canadians, you white people in Canada and the United States, you're going to physically be deported off of the land. Title to this real estate is going to be sized. There won't be any mistakes. And it will be for a cause. And that cause, the purpose, the reason that it's going to be done is to divorce us from any claim that we might have to the land. Now, we've been claiming this land, and we don't own it. We claim to own it, but we don't. And the real owner, when he comes back, is going to take the land and deport us from it. And you'll find that in Deuteronomy 28, verse 68. Let me read it to you. For Pat and all the rest of you guys out there interested in land law. It says here, "And the Eternal shall bring you again into Egypt with ships by the way whereof I spoke unto you. You shall see it no more again, and there you shall be sold unto your enemies for bondsmen and bondwomen, and no man shall buy you." Now, let me tell you, boys and girls, when Americans and Canadians, Australians and New Zealanders, and Europeans fall into the hands of those Muslims, after what we have done to those people over the last 100 years, you know the old adage that says, "God help us"? It won't do you any good. Because in 1 Samuel chapter 8, God told you plainly. He said, "You will cry out to me in that day because of this king that you're demanding, and in that day I will not hear you." So boys and girls, as the old adage goes, you know, bend over and grab your knees and kiss your ass goodbye. Because that's what's coming down. Now, for those few people who do obey God and keep His commandments, there's a little different story. And that story is recorded over here in Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3 has a little story over here for just a few people. I don't know whether these Indians up here in Turtle Island are going to be a part of them. They could be if they wanted to. Listen to this. Verse 7, he says, this is Revelation 3, verse 7. He says, "To the angel of the church in Philadelphia, you write these things, says he that is holy and that's true, and that has the key of David, he that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. He says, I know your works. Behold, I've set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. Because you have a little strength, and you have kept my word, and you have not denied my name. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not Jews, but they do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. So behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which you have, that no man takes your crown. And him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more, and I'll write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I'll write upon him a new name. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Key verse, verse 10. "Because you have kept the word of my patience." Well, that word patience means commandments, and you'll see that in Revelation 14, verse 12. So if you want to code plead that word patience out, go to Revelation 14, 12, and it says there plainly that patience is the commandments of God. "Because you have kept the commandments of God, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation." Now go look at the word temptation here. That's the great tribulation. "I will keep you from the great tribulation." Now that's pretty good benefit, I'd say. Pretty good benefit. Now there's 15 agricultural laws I mentioned to you a little bit ago or a few minutes ago. Now let's take a look at some of these. The land Sabbath and the year of Jubilee. There's also the gleaning law. It's against the law to glean your fields. The law of cattle interbreeding. Leviticus 19:19. It's against the law to crossbreed cattle. The law of hybrid seed, Leviticus 19:19 again. It's against the law to hybridize your seed. We Americans have gone far beyond hybridization. We're now up to genetic modification. I mean, we're gene splicing. We're splicing fish onto tomato seeds. Now, you know, just because you can invent something like an atomic bomb doesn't mean that you should. Now that the atomic genie is out of the jar, our leaders are telling us, you know, it's not a matter of if some terrorist group gets hold of a nuclear weapon, a suitcase bomb left over from the Cold War. It's a matter of when that happens. You can rest assured that if there's any Muslim terrorists out there that can get hold of one of those suitcase bombs and sneak it into the United States, they're going to do it. You can rest assured that's going to happen. Now that genie is out of the jar, and I would contend that we are not better off, safer, more secure, or happier because we now have nuclear energy. I think we would have been better off if we would never have discovered that genie. And the same thing is true now of our food processors. You know, just because we can gene splice these GMOs together, and we can make what we call food out of that and sell that in the supermarket and make a lot of money, doesn't mean that we should be doing that or that we should be in there encouraging these people by buying their products. Now, if there's anything in a modern American supermarket that is fit for human consumption, it has been so well hidden from me, I have yet to find it. I don't know of anything in a Walmart store fit for human consumption, food. Now, they tell me that they're going to start handling, I just saw an article the other day, organic foods in a Walmart store. I may have to eat my own words. There may be, as time progresses, some actual products in a Walmart store or in a Jewel Tea store or in a Safeway store that might be fit for human consumption. Generally speaking, the people who are growing organic foods are concerned about the welfare of the people who are eating those foods. I know I am here. We're very careful here. When we buy cattle feed, that cattle feed is organic and that the cattle feed is not GMO. And that our processes here are natural and that they do fit with all of these 15 agricultural laws in the scripture. It's good for our business and it's good for you if you're eating the meat, milk, butter, and eggs. Now there's an inheritance law that goes along with this and a landmark law. And then there's the redemption of the firstborn and the law of first fruits. And then there's the law of blood and fat. You know, when we kill an animal here, we have to bleed it and bleed it correctly. And when we sell meat here, we produce meat, first of all, which is not fat to start with. Let me tell you something about fat meat. We have in this country what we call fat cattle. Charolais, Whiteface, Santa Gertrudis. These cattle have what we call marbled fat in their meat. Now remember, animals put on weight at the rate of about 1 pound a day. If they're just out here eating grass and living life normally, why, they're putting on about a pound a day. In a feedlot, they can put on 3 pounds a day. In some cases, it's as much as 5 pounds a day. 5 pounds a day. Can you believe that? And what they're putting on is fat. So they raise them up as wieners. As soon as they wean them, they ship them off to the feedlots, and then they start putting in a lot of chemicals and a lot of high-tech feed. This high-tech feed does not have all of the nutrients that these animals need, and that's why they get sick. That's why they have to be fed antibiotics all the time. That's why they give them these chemicals, to make them put on more weight. And the weight that they're putting on is fat. Because an animal can put on fat at about 5 times the rate that they can put on muscle. 5 times the rate. And after all, the farmer doesn't get paid for muscle. He gets paid by the pound. He gets paid for the pounds he produces. And that's why our fat cattle are about 25% fat. So you got this big 1,000-pound steer, this 1,000-pound cow, and she's about 25% fat. So when the guy goes into the sale barn and buys that cow and he's paying, you know, $1 a pound, he's paying about $250 for the fat that's on that cow. Now that's waste. By the law of God, that's waste. He doesn't want to waste that. So he takes that fat and he wants to sell it to you in the steak. Or he wants to sell that to you in the prime rib. And it's marbled in the meat and you can't get it out. Oh, it tastes great. I'm not arguing about the taste. It tastes good. You'll love it. You'll love it. But that fat in your body cannot digest. And it will go through your digestive tract and it will lodge in your arteries and it over time will give you atherosclerosis. It'll plug up your arteries and then you'll have to have bypass surgery, which is why you need to have health insurance. Now here, we raise Jersey cows and they have about 6% body fat. Scotch Highland cows have about 6% body fat and so do buffalo. These animals that have low body fat in relation to the muscle take longer to grow and they cost more. You see, a cow can be ready for market in about 12 months. My cows can't be ready for market for about 3 years. So it takes me three times as long to produce a product for market, which means I've got to have three times as much money. And when I tell you I want three times as much money for my organic beef, you choke up and you say, well, you're nothing but a price gouger and I'm not going to do business with you. I told you about the lady came here and she wanted to buy a dozen eggs and I said, yeah, just leave $2 over there in the cookie jar. And she said, I can buy these eggs for $1 in the store. I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that at all. When you tell me that you can buy meat in the grocery store for about one-third what I charge, I don't doubt that. I think you're telling the truth. I think that's probably true. But I'm not going to pay you $2 a pound to eat my beef. I don't care whether you eat it or not. I don't need you. You don't need me. You go eat that stuff out of the feedlot. That's the stuff with mad cow disease. That's the Downer cow syndrome cow. That's the cow with the antibiotics. You don't need to go to the doctor to get a shot of penicillin. Hell, all you got to do is eat the meat out of the meat market. All you got to do is eat the chicken that comes out of these factory farms over here. Of course, there's the avian flu problem. Yeah, of course, there's a little mad cow disease problem. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's these disease problems that come from these factory farms, which, after all, make all the sense in the world. You can't blame the farmer. You can't blame the businessman for wanting to produce beef on a feedlot because he can do it for one-third the cost. He can sell it to you for one-third what I can sell it to you for, and it tastes better. It's just that it's going to kill you, that's all. And so, of course, these are choices that you have to make. So Edward Faulkner came along and he said, now let me tell you what the problem is with the mechanization of agriculture. We have converted agriculture, which is a biological process, into an industrialized process. We have industrialized our agriculture, and we now have an industrial product. Now, you know, oil is necessary and imperative for you. You have to have oil in your diet. You've got to have olive oil, or you've got to have some kind of oil, fat, in your diet. Not animal fat. Remember, God told you not to eat that animal fat, but you've got to have this fat. So they take fat, they take it out of corn, and they hydrogenize it. It's called hydrogenated corn oil. And they chemically treat it, and they treat it just like they would the oil that comes out of the ground. I mean, it's an industrial process. They refine it. They load it into railroad tank cars by the tens of thousands of gallons and ship it all over America and put it into your Oreo cookies. But over time, when you eat that, not that those Oreos taste bad. There ain't nothing better than a cold glass of milk and a package of Oreo cookies. I'm not knocking Oreos now. I'm just telling you that when you eat them, you get the hydrogenated oil, which then blocks your arteries and gives you stroke or heart attack or some kind of cardiovascular disease. You want to know what causes these diseases. It's the poisons that you create and eat in your food, or it's the nutritional deficiencies. That is, you're growing food on soil that's infertile, or you're using hybridized or GMO seed on good, clean, organic soil. Or worse, you're using GMO seed on worn-out soil with chemical fertilizers and sprays. So you're poisoning and starving yourself all at the same time. And then you put additives in this food like MSG to make it taste good so that you can become addicted to this food. And it tastes good. And you're addicted to it, and you like it like a junkie likes heroin. I don't deny it. But the question that I raised in the series of programs, is that good for you? No, if you think it is, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But there are laws that concern fruit trees, and then there's laws concerning animals, and there's laws that concern clean and unclean meat. There's certain meats that are fit for human consumption, and there are certain meats that are fit for predator consumption. And coyotes and wolves and buzzards and worms and bacteria can digest foods that you can't. You know, a coyote can go over here and eat a week-old carcass of beef that has been decimated by flies and maggots for a week, and he can eat the meat and the maggots and the flies and the green slime and thrive on it. My God, if you got that, you'd get food poisoning and die. Now, you know, most people can look at that carcass and say, well, that's not fit for human consumption. But they're unable to look at other meats, other foods, and say, hey, that's not fit for human consumption. So tuck it away in your heart, boys and girls. Not everything that looks good or tastes good is fit for human consumption. Now, health begins with soil nutrition. And the healthier the soil is, the healthier the plants that come out of the soil are going to be, and the healthier the animals are going to be that eat those healthy plants. So the next time someone says, what causes cancer? The answer is poison or starvation. What causes heart disease and stroke? Poison and starvation. What causes disease? Poison and starvation. And it all begins in the soil. It all begins with soil fertility. Well, I'm about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. Remember, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.